That was to condense the information so I could fit it in 20 minutes. It looks like I'm going to have a little bit more time. So I'm going to break out my more in-depth notes. But it still runs in the same order as the handout, so the handout should be applicable. Today, Gordy asked me to speak on creation science. Creation science can be broken down into two different main headings. Number one, the case for creation, and number two, the case against evolution. The case for creation, first off, the way college and high school professors talk, you would think that evolution is a proven fact, okay? In actuality, it is not. How many people here have heard of the scientific method? Okay? The scientific method starts with observation. Then you propose a question or a problem. You make a hypothesis, which is an educated guess. You experiment. And then you come up with a theory, a hypothesis with a high degree of probability. And if it's accepted or shown to be valid on a universal scale, it's called a natural law. So the natural laws are the strongest things that science can come up with. We're going to see that there's a lot of natural laws that evolution violates. We're also going to see now with the scientific method, it has to start with what? Observation. If it starts with observation, guess what? You cannot observe the beginning of the universe. You cannot observe life evolving from non-life. You cannot observe one species evolving into another species. In other words, the creation and evolution are what scientists call, or at least should call, models. They are neither one of them. You can't even get started on the scientific method. So they're nowhere near a scientific fact. Obviously, they're nowhere near a scientific law or a scientific theory. Evolution is not even a theory. Evolution is a model. Just as creation, scientifically speaking, is a model. A model is merely the way to interpret the evidence. The creationists will look at a fossil, and the evolutionists will look at a fossil, and they'll both agree to the existence of the fossil. They'll interpret it differently. So keep in mind, this idea that evolution is a biological fact, that's false. It's not even a scientific law. It's not even a scientific theory because it cannot be observed. It's a singular event that occurred in the past. Each jump, the origin of the universe, if there was an origin, we'll get into that. The origin of first life and the origin of new life forms. So creation and evolution, scientifically speaking, are models. They are not, you can't refer to them as scientific facts. They're ways to interpret the evidence. So what I want to do is look at the case for creation. What we're going to do is we're going to take the creation model and put it head-to-head with the evolution model and see which one is more plausible. Three main areas, as you see on your handout, are the origin of the universe, the beginning of the universe, the origin of first life, that first single-celled animal supposed to have popped out of primordial soup, and the origin of new life forms. Okay? Now, the origin of the universe, there are two scientific data, if you want to call it that, that argue very heavily in favor of the case for creation. The first is energy deterioration, also known as the second law of thermodynamics. Okay? Now, as soon as you see the second law of thermodynamics, one little three-letter word should jump out off the page and hit you right between the eyes, and that's the word law. The second law of thermodynamics, the laws of science are some of the most firmest things that science has ever proven. This is the end of the scientific model. This is the best that you can, the scientific method. This is the best that you can hope for, is to find a scientific law. So if evolution isn't compatible with a scientific law, if you've got a model over here and it doesn't agree with a scientific law, what should you throw out the window? And the answer is you throw out your model. Your model's not even observable. But the second law of thermodynamics, energy deterioration, tells us that the amount of usable energy in the universe is running down. Okay, now the first law, I don't want to confuse you, the first law, the amount of energy in the universe remains constant, but the amount of usable energy is running down. Energy becomes less and less usable for us. What this shows us is that if you go forward in time, it's becoming less and less usable. So if you go backwards in time, eventually you're going to reach a point where all the energy in the universe was usable. In other words, this tells us that the universe is winding down, and since it's winding down, it had to be wound up. The universe is going to have an end, and therefore the universe had a beginning. The Big Bang model also confirms this. It's not as strong as a scientific law, but it also confirms this. The universe is expanding in all different directions at an equal rate, so that if you go back in time, it's the same phenomenon that you would get with an explosion. So that if you go back in time, it's getting more and more dense. So scientists say that eventually you go far enough back in time and it reaches a point of infinite density. Some to be infinitely dense, it means to be infinitely small. You can only be finitely small. If you're infinitely small, it means you're small without limit. It means you're non-existent. In other words, it's scientific language. It's a way for scientists to say that you go back far enough in time and the universe did not exist without them saying that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. But the Big Bang model and the second law of thermodynamics point to the creation model as far as the origin of the universe as being more plausible. Because the universe had a beginning, it wasn't eternal, it had a beginning, and therefore something outside the universe had to cause it to come into existence. Something doesn't just evolve into existence out of nothing. Remember the philosophical premise is that nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can cause nothing. So if the universe popped into existence out of nothing, something had to cause it to come into existence, something outside the universe. The origin of first life. Evolution teaches spontaneous generation, that life came from non-life without intelligent intervention. However, the creation model says that an intelligent being intervened to bridge the gap from non-life to life. Spontaneous generation violates the law. Again, that's a key word, law. The law of biogenesis. The law of biogenesis just says that all life comes from prior existing life forms. But spontaneous generation violates the law of biogenesis and the cell theory. The cell theory is that the cell is the basic, the smallest unit of life. And all cells came from pre-existing cells. But then in your college textbooks, it'll say, of course this doesn't apply to the first living cell, which had to have evolved from non-living material. Well, where's the evidence for that? They present no evidence for that. They just assume that's the way it must be, since obviously God doesn't exist. So it's assumed that God doesn't exist. It's never proven that God doesn't exist. What you have is, in a single-celled animal, you have what is called specified complexity. Okay? Specified complexity is very much like human language. I can't remember which is which, but the specific part is something like, I don't know if it's the letters of the letters that make up a word, and the complexity is when you have like sentences, complete thoughts. But our language is very much like what we find in the genetic information in a single cell. They used to say there's enough genetic information in a single cell to fill one volume of an encyclopedia. They've changed that. Now they've come to the conclusion there's enough genetic information, even in a single-celled animal, to fill an entire library. Okay? So now the question comes up, can natural laws by themselves produce this highly complex information? You have a Christian philosopher, Norman Geisler, says that natural laws can explain the Grand Canyon, but natural laws cannot explain the faces on Mount Rushmore. You find a watch in the wilderness, like William Paley said, and you know that it had to be designed. It has order and complexity. Well, the amount of complexity in a single cell is much greater than the amount of complexity that you're going to find in a watch. And so, you know, the illustration that's often given here is how many explosions would you need to have in a print shop before, by chance, out would pop a Webster's Dictionary. Well, now that illustration needs to be updated, we should say how many random explosions do you need to have before by chance you would create a whole entire library. And it just can't be done. Intelligent intervention is needed. And so again, the creation model is more plausible. Now, Carl Sagan would disagree, but Carl Sagan has gone on record by saying that a single message from outer space would prove intelligent life on other planets. Well, if a single message from outer space, single intelligent message from outer space would prove life on other planets, then my question to Mr. Sagan is, how come an entire library's worth of information in a single cell doesn't improve and it doesn't prove an intelligent cause? He seems to have a double standard there. By the way, all these experiments, the Miller and Urey experiments, I don't know if you know about them. What's the one factor in every one of them where, and they, by the way, they have not gotten life from non-life. Dr. Wickramasinghe from Great Britain, one of the leading scientists in the world today, as he calls those experiments cheating because they start with amino acids, the building blocks of life, which is like a, what a sentence is to a library, that's what amino acids are to life. They start with that sentence, they break it down, and then they recover it again. And they say, well, we've got life and non-life in the lab, and that's not the case. Dr. Wickramasinghe calls it cheating because it says they start with what they're trying to end up with. But even beyond that, even if they got life from non-life in the lab, what would they be using that would not favor the evolution model? And the answer, of course, is intelligence. It takes human intelligence to bring order where there is disorder. And so that would only prove the creation model, because the creation model says that intelligent intervention was needed. And of course, that was done by an intelligent God. The origin of new life forms. When you look at the fossil record, new life forms appear suddenly and fully developed. In other words, you don't find half wings and half fins. Okay? Every time, every Archaeopteryx and every proposed missing link they've ever suggested has been shown to be fully developed. You don't find anything in between. In fact, Charles Darwin said, in his writings, he did not claim to prove evolution in the Origin of Species. He said, these are the things that you'll have, I'm making a proposal, these are the things that you're going to have to find to prove me right. Well, we never found them. But then he turned around and said, these are the things you're going to have to find to prove me wrong. And we found some of them. One of those things would be the lungs of birds are so different from the lungs of any other creatures that it's a totally different structure. So if an animal evolved into a bird and then a bird evolved into another animal, during the 100,000 to 10 million years or whatever the evolutionist wants, depending on what view he holds to go from anything to a bird, all during the intermediate period, you would have lungs that would not be fully developed. In other words, you would have an animal that can't breathe for a few million years. There's no way you're going to evolve into a bird. There's no way you're going to evolve from being a bird to something else. You've got a completely different system that's not going to work until it's fully developed. The origin of new life forms, we were talking about this on the fossil record, the new life forms appear suddenly and fully developed. So they don't find these missing links. A lot of evolutionists now are becoming what they hold to a view called punctuated equilibrium. Stephen Jay Gould is the one that holds to it. And it almost sounds like what they're saying is two apes got together and had a baby boy, and enough baby boys and baby girls were born around the same time, so they started the human race, and when you check with the fossil record, there's no gaps between apes and men, because there are really no gaps. There were no intermediate forms. We came directly from it, just a macro mutation type thing. That is not what they're really claiming. But that's what they're claiming. They're trying to explain why the fossil record appears that way. There's no gaps in between there. And what they're really claiming is that the evolutionary thing, instead of taking gradual millions of years to occur, by the way, evolution means gradual change, so punctuated equilibrium is a contradiction of evolution anyway. But instead of taking millions of years, it took maybe 100,000 years or less. And then these transitional forms weren't doing too hot, and so they just kind of died out before any of them were fossilized. Well, that seems to be a real smart way to dance around the issue. The fact is, there are no missing links in a fossil record. So if you don't have the missing links, why hold on to evolution and say, well, the missing links were never fossilized? That's just explaining away the evidence against your view rather than really dealing with it. So these gaps in the fossil record, there's no evidence for missing links. And then also the human brain. The human brain contains enough information to fill 20 million volumes of encyclopedia. Okay? That's a tremendous amount of information. Now, natural law cannot produce 20 million volumes of encyclopedia from a library's worth of information. In other words, from a single cell down. You got a library's worth of information, and somehow you've got to evolve until you get to 20 million volumes of encyclopedia. Again, intelligent intervention is needed to impart more complex information. Evolution is like the point of mutations as the process by which evolution takes place. However, mutations do not add more complex information to the genetic code. What I'm getting at here, your genetic code determines the color hair you're going to have, the kind of teeth you're going to have, the shape of your nose, everything was all there in a genetic code. It's like the blueprint for who you, your physical characteristics and all. Just assume that, just for an illustration, assume that there's 26 letters in the genetic code, okay? So let's say we got like the English alphabet, 26 letters, and now a mutation occurs. All a mutation does, it doesn't add a 27th or a 28th or a 29th letter. It adds no new information. All it does is it garbles those other 26, so they're in a different order. So when a mutation occurs, it doesn't give you any new genetic information to get anything new out of it. And in other words, Charles Ryrie, in one of his books, a Christian theologian, asked the questions, where did single-celled animals get genes for teeth? A single-celled animal does not have any genetic information to develop teeth. Now, if mutations only garble the genetic code that's already in that single-celled animal, where in the world is he getting the genetic information to someday evolve to the point where now they get teeth? It doesn't make sense. With the evolutionary framework, we all came from single-celled animals. So again, intelligent intervention is needed. Time plus chance plus natural laws never produce more complex information, and therefore you need an intelligent God not only to go to bring the universe into existence out of nothing, the origin of the universe. You also need an intelligent God for the origin of first life and then the origin of new life forms. So let's take a look at the case against evolution. We already talked about the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Together they are... You need both of them together to show that evolution doesn't explain the origin of the universe. Reason being is because if you had... Let's say all you had was the second law of thermodynamics, the amount of usable energy is winding down, you could still... There's the possibility that new energy could start pumping into the universe. New usable energy. Well, when you take out with the first law of thermodynamics, that says the amount of energy in the universe remains constant. There's no new energy coming in. The amount of energy remains constant, but when it goes through changes, it becomes less and less usable. And so you put both of those together, and it tells us that the universe had to have a beginning. If the universe was eternal, there would be the same amount of usable energy throughout all time. But that is not the case. The dating methods, the evolutionary dating methods that they use are inconsistent and unreliable. It's based on a principle called uniformitarianism. Uniformitarianism is an assumption. It's something that scientists have never proven. All that uniformitarianism says is that the processes that are occurring today, especially the processes of decay, which they use very often for dating methods, those processes that are occurring today have occurred at the same rate throughout all time. As far back as you go in the past, those processes were occurring at the same rate. There's no way for them to prove that. They have to assume it. Now, by assuming it, they have to assume that there was no worldwide catastrophes. In other words, if the flood of Noah was true, a worldwide flood, it throws their whole system of thought, the whole principle of uniformitarianism, can be thrown in a waste paper basket. Because it assumes this constant rate of decay, a worldwide catastrophe would change that. Now, rocks known to have been only a few hundred years old have been dated to be hundreds of millions of years old. They took rocks that were formed a couple hundred years ago by a known volcano. They knew when they were formed. They tried it with their dating methods, and they dated them to be hundreds of millions of years old. So the dating methods are not real reliable. Now, Dr. Henry Morris, a Christian who is a scientist, stated that there's many different ways to date the Earth's age, but evolutionists only use those methods which give astronomically old dates, since evolution needs millions of years just to seem slightly possible. Okay? Now, there are many good arguments for a young Earth. Now, I'm going to say this, though. Evolutionists must have an old Earth. Creationists, you have creationists who are scientists like you, Ross, who still believe in an old Earth. I tend to favor a young Earth, but I'm open to dialogue on the subject. Henry Morris is a Christian, and he's a scientist. He holds to a young Earth. There are Christians in both camps. That is not a determining factor. In other words, if you prove the universe is old, it doesn't disprove creation. But if you prove the universe is young, it does disprove evolution. Again, the fossil record is a tremendous problem with evolution because, as we mentioned earlier, there's gaps and there's no intermediary forms, no missing links, no half fins or half wings. By the way, fossilization is extremely rare today, and it's caused by rapid burial. Rapid burial. See, in order for something to be fossilized, it's got to kind of be embedded very rapidly and buried very rapidly before it even decays. Okay? Otherwise, you wouldn't get a fossil. And so a worldwide flood would actually do it. Even if you had millions upon millions upon millions of years, you would not have enough time if fossilization occurred throughout all time at the same rate that it is occurring today. You would not have a fossil record, the massive fossilization that we find around the globe today. Right there, that should tell scientists that they need to throw out uniformitarianism. But then if they throw out uniformitarianism, they throw out one of the biggest bases for evolution that they have. The supposed missing links between apes and men, another problem for evolution. Neanderthal man and Cro-Magnon man, turns out they both have features of modern man, and they're probably just that, modern man. Colorado man, turned out to be a member of the horse family. A lot of these things, you would be surprised, these supposed missing links. And by the way, they still show up in your college textbooks. But even the guys who wrote those textbooks will not try to defend them in a debate. They openly admit in their more scholarly writings that these things have been proven false. They're just not in a rush to update the textbooks. And it's pretty tough to convince college-age students who have a lot of questions on their minds that evolution is true when they find out that when you start with an ape on one end and then you got a human on the other end, all those in between turn out to be either fully human or fully apes or members of horse families, whatever. These guys, there's a lot to do with imagination here. Sometimes they'll find a tooth and try to construct a whole race of missing links. Sometimes it'll be a portion of a jaw. But Colorado man was a member of the horse family. Java man turned out to be a large gibbon. Heidelberg man consisted only of a lower jaw. God only knows what it is. Piltdown man turned out to be a clever hoax. I believe they wired either a jaw of an ape to a human's face or a jaw of a human to an ape's face. I'm not sure which, but it turned out to be a clever hoax. Peking man turned out to be a large monkey or a baboon. The southern ape and Ramapithecus also turned out to be extinct apes. East African man turned out to be an ape. And Dryopithecus turned out to be an extinct ape. And my favorite one, Nebraska man, a 1925 monkey trial. Anybody remember that movie? Spencer Tracy was before your time, but it's kind of before my time too. But I don't want to date myself too much here. But the guy, they're trying to get evolution was not allowed to be taught in a public school. So the ACLU back in the 1820s argued it's unfair just to teach creation. You have to teach creation and evolution. Now they lost the case, but eventually both were taught anyway. Well, now in the 1980s, the ACLU has argued it's wrong to teach creation in the public schools. We have to teach evolution only. Right now, the ACLJ is arguing a case that hasn't gone to the Supreme Court yet that is arguing that creation should be taught side by side with evolution. Because otherwise, if you teach only evolution, you're favoring the religion of secular humanism, basically the religion of atheism. But anyway, during the trial, they had the Bible believer in a witness stand. And the lawyer came up and said, "Do you know what this tooth is?" And the Bible believer said, I don't know what it is. And he said, "Well, let me tell you, scientists found this tooth. And from this tooth, they constructed a skull." Now, he didn't tell them they constructed the skull totally from their own imagination based on the shape of the tooth. Okay? "And from the skull, they constructed an entire skeleton, an entire body." Again, imagination. You want to talk about imagination, by the way. You know the hair that just starts growing on those bodies in the textbooks and stuff? And the hair that starts leaving the bodies until you get a human being with less hair than a monkey had? There's no way of telling from the bone structure how much hair or how little hair a creature had on their body. So that's all imagination. That's all that is. Anyway, so he told them, from the skeleton, they constructed an entire race of missing links. And the Bible believer was just stunned. He didn't even know about this latest scientific find. Well, what they don't tell you in that movie is 2 years later, they found some more teeth in the same area. Some more of the same type of teeth, except they also found the skulls and the skeletons. And Nebraska man, it turned out to be the tooth of an extinct pig. Okay? So we're not being given all the facts. And we need to look further into this. But supposed missing links between apes and men, another problem for evolution. Archaeopteryx, I talked about that a little bit. It was thought to be a transitionary form between reptiles and birds because it has teeth and a lizard-like tail and claws, all like a reptile, yet it has wings and feathers like a bird. However, everything is fully developed. You know, its wings are legitimate wings. I mean, its feathers are legitimate feathers. It's not scales turning into feathers and something else turning into wings. It's fully developed, and most scientists now classify it fully as a bird. It's not an an intermediary form is not something that looks like that and looks like that. It's got to be something that's either totally in this group or totally in that, or well, intermediate form's got to be kind of half and half. And nobody's ever found any fossils for them. That's number one. And number two, there's no way those things could even live. I mean, let's face it, what in the world would you do with a half fin and a half wing? I mean, you can't swim and you can't fly. You can't walk. So you're going to be, for I guess the next 100,000 to 5 million years, you're going to be just rolling around in the mud. I don't know. Anybody heard of Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy? Okay, it's a theory in quantum physics, and it's basically just subatomic particle movement is presently unpredictable for man. Now, a lot of people have said because of this principle, that proves that things can happen without a cause, and therefore the universe could have popped into existence out of nothing. By the way, this principle, you cannot do science. Be honest with you, you really can't even start any branch of thought without a religious presupposition, without a religious assumption, without a religious worldview. When you start drawing conclusions, you've got to have some worldview to draw to interpret the data that you're dealing with. Modern science was started by Christians. Now, then atheists took it over. But now that has become so bankrupt that what we're going to see with Heisenberg's principle, you're going to see New Agers beginning to take over science. It's already happening right now. And they're going to start saying that science disproves logic and things can happen without a cause and that there's evidence that we're all one being, we're all cells of this one being, we're all God, and we're going to see it move in that direction very swiftly. But anyway, but this idea that things happen without a cause, Max Planck, who is a world-renowned physicist, he holds the view that I hold. It simply means that scientists aren't yet able to accurately predict where a specific particle will be at a given time. In other words, all he's saying is the causes are there, we just don't know them. And just because we don't know them doesn't mean that the causes aren't there. Man is not omniscient, he is not all-knowing. In short, there's many proven unproven assumptions that evolutionists make. We talked about the fact there's no evidence for spontaneous generation, life coming from non-life without intelligent intervention. There's no evidence that the universe is eternal. All the evidence shows that the universe is not eternal. We know that the universe couldn't evolve from nothing. There's no proof for intelligence coming from non-intelligence without an intelligent being bringing that about. There's no evidence for multi-celled animals coming from single-celled animals. Even an embryo, human embryo, does not evolve into a human being because he has his full genetic code in place at the moment of conception. And when you were a single cell, you had the genetic information for your teeth. A single-celled animal never had genetic information for teeth. So you're human from the moment of conception. There's no evidence for animals with backbones coming from animals without backbones. No evidence for the common ancestry of fish, reptiles, birds, and mammals, because common anatomy, common body parts, could point just as easily to common design or a common designer as they would to a common ancestry. For instance, if you looked at two paintings that were very similar, most likely it's a common designer. It wasn't that one painting evolved into the other painting. When you look at all this together, what you find is that evolution itself is an unproven assumption. Now, what I'd like to close with is this statement. Evolution needs God, but God doesn't need evolution. What I mean by that is, if evolution is true, all these jumps from nothing to something, from non-life to life, from simple life forms to complex life forms, from animals without backbones, animals with backbones, right on down the line. Every one of those jumps violates scientific laws. And the only way that evolution could be true would be if you had a miracle-working God who could perform, can supersede the laws of nature to make those jumps. Okay? So if evolution is true, it would still need God. However, if God used evolution, he covered his tracks. But he sure didn't leave any much evidence for it, if any. That's number one. Number two, if God exists, he didn't need evolution. He could have started the evolutionary process and let it occur on its own, or he could have created the universe in 6 days if he wanted to. So I think that what we need to recognize is that evolution needs God, but God does not need evolution. Once Galileo was scoffed at by fellow scientists for believing the Earth revolved around the Sun. Now creationists are being ridiculed for saying, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the Earth. As the decades pass, creation science will be vindicated, just as Galileo was vindicated by future study. Unfortunately, many evolutionists may never be able to abandon the blind faith they hold in the dead and unscientific religion called evolution. Okay, in this study that we're going to have today, I was just going to keep the subject on evolution. If you have any questions, we can have a question and answer period on creation versus evolution. But that's all I have.
When you talk about creation science and evolution, evolutionary science, how can you call those two fields science when both are only theory that can't be proven? Science deals with things that basically can be proven.
Okay, you really don't have a... It's really not a good understanding of science. Number one, science, before science even starts, they've got a whole lot of assumptions, that philosophical assumptions that cannot be proven, such as the chair I have in my mind, is that just a representation of the chair, or is it the real chair, you know? And those things, philosophers are still debating those questions today. And So, number one, science doesn't deal with just what is only proven. Number two, evolution is not a theory, it's a model. A theory that's accepted on a universal scale becomes a law, but it's a theory is one of the end results of the scientific method. But in order to start the scientific method, you need observation. And since nobody was here to observe the universe either evolving out of nothing or being created by God, since nobody was here to observe the first life and then new life forms, you can't even start a scientific method. Now, the problem is, the guys that say both science and evolution are not... When the evolutionist says that creation is not science, it's just religion, he's using a different standard for creation than he is for science. Because if creation is just religion, then so also should evolution. Atheistic evolution should be religion as well. But in actuality, what the big problem is most scientists are horrible philosophers of science. They don't understand the overall field that they're in. They understand their individual, you know, if a guy's a geologist, he knows the geology. But he doesn't understand his whole field. In actuality, the founders of modern science had two distinct areas of science, two main areas of science, origin science and operation science. Operation science observes, it deals with the observable, repeatable processes that are occurring today. Which would deal with the scientific method. But origin science cannot be observed because it deals with singular events of the past, such as the beginning of the universe, if there was one, life evolving from non-life, if that occurred. But it's the same with the creation model. Creation by God, if it occurred, could not be observed by anybody but God. Creation of the first life and of new life forms could not be observed by anybody but God. So both of them are non-observable, so they're singular events of the past. And so rather than using the scientific method, what has to be used is the principles of analogy, also known as uniformity, which is not uniformitarianism. Uniformity just, and by the way, so the principle of analogy or uniformity and the principle of causality. Causality, that principle simply says that every effect needs an adequate cause. Okay? If you walked into this room and your coffee was on the table and you walked into this room and now the coffee was completely gone and you saw three or four of these guys sitting around, you would begin to ask them, because you would be looking for a scientific reason why your coffee has disappeared. So every event or every effect needs an adequate cause, principle causality. Secondly, so that if the universe came into existence, it's an effect, it would need a cause. But then also, and you know, and to get more intelligent, more complex information, there would need an intelligent cause there. But then also the principle of analogy, the principle of uniformity, just basically says that all we have is the present. So we kind of assume that the present is the key to unlocking the past. Now, to take it to the uniformitarian assumption is to go too far, to say the processes that are occurring now have occurred at this rate throughout all time. That's going too far. But we have to hope that the present is the key to the past, and both the creation scientists and the evolutionary scientists both agree with that. But it says that the principle of analogy is similar. If we find a similar effect in the present and we know its cause, if we go back and find a similar effect in the past, it should also have a similar cause. And when we find that Webster's dictionaries have intelligent causes, then we look at a single cell, which is much more complex than that, has much more specified complexity than that, then that should also take an intelligent cause as well. So But as far as are they both scientific, yeah, as long as we recognize that they fall under origin science and not operation science. Norman Geisler, and I think a guy named Anderson, wrote a book, Origin Science, which is really, really good. One of the best philosophy of science works that I've read in a long time. Geisler and I think it's J. Kirby Anderson or something?
The big co-author.
Yeah, it's called Origin Science. Baker Bookhouse published it. And
now, another thing he says when we're discussing creation science is that Christians were the ones who developed and started science.
Yeah. Modern science.
Well, you know, I have a lot of questions about that because, I mean, you listen to what history has said, that the Greeks were very...
It wasn't modern science, though.
Well, I mean, if it wasn't for the Greeks, I mean, who was it? Was it a Greek who said that originally said that the world was round and not flat, you know, because of the horizon? Mm-hmm. And they had a lot of developments themselves mm-hmm. in science. So, I mean, how can you say that's not modern science? Because they were starting the foundation.
You even had evolutionists back then. Evolution goes way back, predates Christ. But there's no real debate about the start of modern science. The start of modern science, people trace back to the Galileos and Newtons, Francis Bacon. And so whether you're an evolutionist or a creationist, that's not really open to debate. That's when they began to use induction and make it more of a scientific approach, and more of experimentation entered into the procedure. But even then, they realized there was a distinction between operation and origin science. And the reason why, too, with this, let me just read through my notes on the brief history of the evolution-creation debate. The creation model dominated modern science before 1860. Modern science was started by men who believed in God's existence. Men like Galileo, Isaac Newton, Francis Bacon, Johannes Kepler, and Blaise Pascal. Their belief in God's existence formed the basis for modern science. Now, the reason for this is that they believed that a reasonable God created the universe in a reasonable way, so that through reason, man can find out about the universe in which we live. Let me repeat that. They believe that a reasonable God created the universe in a reasonable way, so that through reason, man can find out about the universe in which we live. In other words, they said, when we think we see a chair, and we rub our eyes, and we really make sure we're awake, and we go walk up and touch that chair, and smell that chair, and sit down on that chair, we can be pretty sure that there really is a chair there, because God wouldn't be deceiving us. The problem with modern science now, since it's dominated by evolution, is the question comes up, without a reasonable God, can the universe really make sense? Just because the sun, to use phenomenological language, just because the sun rose yesterday, and the day before, and the day before that, is there any reason why we should expect it to rise again tomorrow if there isn't an orderly God who has patterned things that way? And the evolution model dominated modern science after 1860. Around 1860 or 1859, I believe, Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species. He proposed a purely naturalistic explanation for the origin of the universe, first life, and new life forms. He taught that nature can be explained without appealing to a supernatural origin. And so this became the dominant view of science since 1860. But again, without a reasonable God, can we really expect the universe to make sense? And a lot of the assumptions that modern science has to make fit real well with a Christian worldview, that we can feel safe that the external world as it appears to us. See, Immanuel Kant, a tremendous influence on thinkers of today, he said that we can know reality as it appears to us, but we cannot know reality as it actually is. But if you believe in the God of the Bible, the assumption that a reality as it appears to us is actually reality as it really is, that's a safe assumption to make with the God of the Bible, because as Rene Descartes said, God is not a deceiver. He's not an evil demon who's trying to deceive us. But without the God of the Bible, who knows? Who knows? I mean, if in your mind, if that's just a picture, a representation of reality, the only way to know how accurate the representation is to compare it with reality. So my representation, the representation of, of this chair in my mind, the only way for me to see that representation is close to the original is to look at that original chair. Problem is, when I look at that original chair, I just get another representation of it. So I'm comparing two representations, two pictures of the chairs, not the chair, not a, a picture of the chair with the real chair. And so now Augustine solved that problem by saying that that Jesus is he's referred to as the light which comes into the world and enlightens every man. That Jesus as the Word, as the second person of the Trinity, enlightens us and gives us knowledge, things we know that are true, yet we can't prove it infallibly. But you know, modern science has thrown out of this base, this reasonable God, and so the question comes up, without that reasonable God, how do we know the universe is going to make sense? And we really have no guarantee that the universe is going to make sense, and that just because if you one human being drank poison yesterday, it killed them, it doesn't mean that you drink poison today and it's going to kill you. We have no way of knowing. And this is like John Cage, he's where modern postmodern thought is going. He believes that there is no real objective meaning to life, but he openly admits, Francis Schaeffer quotes from him in his works, he openly admits that if he applied his worldview to his favorite hobby, he'd be a dead man right now, because his favorite hobby is eating mushrooms.
Yep.
And if he randomly ate mushrooms without verifying that it was not a poisonous mushroom, he'd be a dead man. Now, he does play music. He believes that everything got here by chance. He's an evolutionist. Everything got here by chance. There's no meaning to life. God didn't design it. So he plays his music like that. Now he is a tremendous performer. He has tremendous talent as a musician, but he chooses not to use it. Instead, he flips a coin to determine the notes he's going to play. In fact, one of his big songs is called 4 Minutes and 33 Seconds. He sits down, he pushes the tucks back, sits down in the chair, opens up the piano, cracks his knuckles, and just sits there in front of the piano and looks at his watch for 4 Minutes and 33 Seconds, closes up the piano, stands up and starts bowing, and everybody starts booing. I'm sure there's probably a few people who throw things at him. And
what's his name?
John Cage. And then there's
I think I've seen this guy on PBS.
Oh, really? And then I'm sure there's some people that probably just start weeping and say, "That's so profound. That's so profound. There was so much meaning in what he said." And when they say, "What did he say?" He said, "Well, he said there was no meaning."
You really mean that?
But Francis Schaeffer used to point out that guy admitted that if he applied that same principle of chance to his hobby of eating mushrooms, he'd be a dead man. So when it comes to eating mushrooms, he lives like the God in the Bible exists, and like the universe does make sense. But to be honest with you, every scientist, whoever conducts an experiment, is living as if the God of the Bible does exist. Whether he wants to explicitly admit that or not is another thing, but he is implying it just by the fact that he assumes the universe makes sense to start out on his experiment.
Well, I was just thinking that the very fact that he titled it 4 Minutes and 33 Seconds,
yeah,
is implying meaning into his nothing.
Because if it had no meaning, it would change every time.
Yeah. Well, not only that, too, is to call it 4 minutes, and I didn't even think of that, but to call it 4 minutes and 33 seconds, he could time it for 2.5 minutes and just stop and still call it 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Because if music, his whole point is music is the same as non-music. Because, you know, he violates the law. There's no meaning, so he violates the law of non-contradiction. So A can equal non-A at the same time in the same way. Well, so you apply that to music, and eventually music was just was planted by chance, but eventually it got to the point where it reached its logical conclusion, which music is non-music. If there is no meaning, then non-music is as much music as music is. And so, but for that matter, then 4 minutes and 33 seconds is as much 4 minutes and 33 seconds as 2 minutes and 7 seconds would be. So there'd be no reason why he shouldn't just stop the song at 2 minutes and 7 seconds.
For someone who believes in chance, and that everything happens with chance with his own song, I mean, by him not playing and just sitting there for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, that's not showing chance either.
Yeah.
Because there's still order there, even with silence, even without him playing. If he wanted to show chance and show a song being made by chance, then he would have to start just banging on the keys and produce the he'd have to produce the same thing every time.
He'd have to randomly do something every time to play this random song.
But the song would have to be the same every time for it to be chance.
The thing is that the... It's just like when I debate guys like on God's existence, and just the fact that they'll take the debate, they've made certain assumptions. And so I try to use only the assumptions that they're giving me just to take the debate. For instance, one of my assumptions would be the basic reliability of sense experience. Well, just the fact the guy showed up on time with clothes, he accepts it. He accepts my existence or he wouldn't be debated. My existence or he wouldn't be debating me. He accepts the existence of himself. He accepts the existence of everybody in the audience. He accepts the existence of the building, you know.
Social standards.
So, and then he also holds to the law of non-contradiction because he believes he's right and I'm wrong because I contradict his view and his view is true. So, a lot of times, if you just take the assumptions that the people make just to take the debate, if you put those assumptions together in a logical form, you find that you come very close to proving the existence of God already. It's like one real easy argument that you can use with either philosophical or scientific evidence for the existence of God is that everything that has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause.
They talk about, you know, evolutionists talk about everything happening by chance. How do they explain then order and the order of the universe, the chance of that happening?
Yeah. They say given enough time,
and the forces that, like,
given enough time, every potentiality will be actualized, but in actuality, given the whole universe is moving from order to disorder and not the other way around. Now granted, we can reverse that. That's what life is all about. We take in that usable energy. But the universe itself, though, is a closed system. When you have to examine it, you have to examine it with the assumption there is nothing outside of it. When you examine it like that, and if it's using its energy up, eventually all its energy is going to be used up. So, you know, there's real problematic for evolution there, but I would use second law, energy deterioration. I use that just primarily to prove the existence of God. That the universe had a beginning and therefore needs a cause. Some guys would use it that are a lot more school in science than me, like Dwayne Gish would even use it to say that any evolution would be downward because of the second law. But he's just talking about even like on Earth. But you have to know a lot more about science than I know to argue from that point. But it can effectively be done.
Would you find that in at least in the
what you have experienced or what you've heard from modern evolutionary proponents, would you find the consensus opinion that the Earth, as we know it, is dying? Or would it be, would they believe that it would be continuing? Now, Bart, forget about what cause may be that it would be continuing or dying. Do they find that it is dying or not?
It's real tough to say. I would say yes and no. Yes, if you look at it from the concept of the whole universe, just about every scientist that I've heard of, even someone like Sagan, who holds to takes a leap of faith against all the scientific evidence and holds to the oscillating model that the universe is eternal, he still believes the universe has to eventually collapse and then just another big bang and then another one, another one. So even in his view, the evolutionary process has to start all over again if it is ever going to start again. So even though he sees the universe as eternal, even with his view of the eternal universe, he still sees the death of this stage of the universe, if you will. And so I would say, and then of course all those who hold to the Big Bang, whether they're Christians or not, and most evolutionists hold to the Big Bang as being, you know, just a one-time deal. Bertrand Russell, for instance. He taught that all the aspirations of man, every invention man ever made, everything he ever stood for, everything he ever did, every act of heroism is eventually going to die in the heat death of the universe. So I would say just about all the scientists that I know, and most, if not all, the philosophers I know, would say that eventually life as we know is going to come to an end, because the universe is going to come to an end.
But they wouldn't.
But whether or not some would say, well, this planet's going to blow up, but the universe is going to go on, I think there you've got probably most of the people that are saying that, most of the scientists that are saying that are fanatical New Agers who've got their own belief. Remember I said to be a scientist, you've got to go into it with some kind of religious worldview? Well, they're bringing their New Age pantheism into it. And they're the people that are screaming about population control and pollution and all that type of stuff. And but the recent statistics show that out of course, these were the guys that were actually full-time scientists, full-time paid scientists from the government working on researching global warming. So it might be a higher percentage among all scientists, but among the scientists that were researching global warming and being paid by the government to do it. And these are not guys who work for the government, but there was government grants and stuff, and so they were independent. But only I think 51% said they weren't sure if global warming was occurring or not. 32% said it's definitely not, and then what's left? Was it 17%? But anyway, there was only 17% that actually said global warming is definitely occurring. Yet, we spend, you know, millions upon millions of dollars of taxpayers' money to prevent something from happening, which less than 17% of the experts say is really occurring.
Well, it's not that, you know, the concept of the universe and particularly the world and life, I'm more or less interested, since we are talking about evolution, mm-hmm. and not so much a cosmological issue, but more on the specific life, mm-hmm. You know, what we consider to be life. It's obvious, at least from all the cackling that's going on in not only evolutionary circles, but the macro-pagan school, mm-hmm. That they believe that this universe, for whatever reason, they say the cause is man, mm-hmm. and somehow this evil, yeah. the only creature that we could probably call evil, is what they would call us, is causing the destruction mm-hmm. of our planet. And yet, you know, and yet the other, yeah. and yet at the other point, too, that there's no way they can stop this process. So, at least it seems to me that if I was not a Christian and didn't know that, hey, God created this world with only a finite amount of material to begin with, and only a finite amount of usable material for life. No, I don't have any problem with that. Yeah. But it seems to me they would, and that would, you know, being a pagan, would probably, you know, the technical definition, they would be scared to death if their God is dying.
Yeah, yeah. And well, there's, you've got the, there's people that believe that the way the planet can be saved is if we worship the planet. The New Agers from that group. And then there's also the belief that this new age of consciousness is going to, the next stage of evolution. By the way, early evolutionists, a lot of them, did have a spiritual stage of evolution. So it was very, very religious to a lot of them, where eventually man would evolve to the point where we would no longer need bodies. What you have is you have a lot of people that hold to this, that man's going to achieve a higher consciousness, we're going to recognize our godhood and the divinity in all things, and we're going to worship the planet and live happily ever after. So a lot of these scare tactic guys, also there's another side to their coin, and that's if everybody can jump on their bandwagon and hug a tree, then we'll all live happily ever after. So, but by the way, Al Gore is one of these kooks, so anyway, the Vice President of the United States, so it's not like these guys are just teaching at community colleges or pumping gas somewhere. These guys are actually holding some high places.
Well, let's go back a little bit. You said, you know, like, if you can do it now, you can probably prove it before, right? You said that earlier.
It's an assumption we make. Well, what we do is we look for hints of the past in the present.
Okay, now, I don't know, I've heard that like some scientists can create cells in a lab, or they can duplicate some cells. They can reconstruct
DNA
they're getting to the point where they can almost clone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they take parts of the code, and then they just, like with Jurassic Park, they fill it in with another species that's very close to it. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what kind of does that do for creationism? Guys are in the lab making life.
No, number one, they're not making life because they're starting with life to begin with. So they're not really making life. Most of the stuff that's done, genetic engineering is a whole different thing. Genetic engineering is changing life. It's not really making life. Yeah, adapting it it is pretty much messing with it to try to figure out if we can, you know. And there's ways that they can. Well, let's say that we found a way to correct Down syndrome, which is a chromosomal imbalance. All that wouldn't be much different than us mending a broken arm or something. For all practical purposes, and if we saw anything, there's nothing creative in it, but if we see there's definitely some design there, but it's intelligent design. So if anything, it just strengthens the creation model, where intelligent design is made to go from disorder to order. With the Miller-Urey experiments, though, they're not even getting life. They're just, all they've done there is taken amino acids, which are the building blocks of life, and they've broken them down, and then they've recovered them. So they're starting with Dr. Wickrama Singh from Great Britain calls them cheating, because they start with what they want to end up with.
Aren't they also doing it in conditions that can never ever happen on Earth?
They're still manipulating it with their intelligence. And about these guys, you know, there's probably as many different theories about the conditions before in the early stages of Earth, or, you know, there's as many different theories about that as there are scientists, probably. So
you would just consider that for the creation model, because it's intelligent manipulation.
And there's, for instance, life coming from non-life. Does the Bible speak out against that or for it, life coming from non-life?
Against it.
Actually, it speaks for it. Because where did God make Adam from?
Dust.
From the ground. From the. Actually, it's more than the dust of the ground because it implies like a wet, muddy. But God made life from non-life. So you're going to find stuff in our bodies that are similar to non-life. At the same time, though, you've got a living, intelligent God who breathed life.
Okay, so into men. When somebody asked me, did life come from non-life?
Yeah.
Were you asking, is just life a compilation of material randomly?
Yeah.
I mean by life coming from life is life had an intelligent beginning.
All I'm getting at there is that we don't want to make a bigger gap than what there really should be between the Christian and the evolutionist. The evolutionist teaches life, the atheistic evolutionist teaches life coming from non-life without intelligent intervention. But the Christian teaches life coming from non-life with intelligent intervention. And it makes sense, too, because you need life. Living beings are, there's much more specified, there's much more complexity and order in living beings than you find in non-living material. It's just the specified complexity that we talked about in single-celled animals, tremendous.
We were talking about global warming here, and how evil man is for heating up the earth and everything. But I've heard the argument go on about this whole thing. It's like they're trying to make excuses for this whole global warming thing. Now I've heard things like kelp are what's causing ozone depletion. And then on the same point, there's people I've heard also scientists saying, well, we don't have to worry about global warming now because the exhaust emissions from ships are repelling the sunlight and repelling the heat and repelling it back into space, so our planet is actually cooling down.
It's like ozone depletion. There's evidence that gets replaced anyway.
Yeah, I've heard that ozone is a natural occurrence every so many. There's a cyclist. Cyclic. Ozone depletes, comes back, depletes, comes back.
And the thing is that, and then it's like Mount Pinatubo or whatever. The destruction that did to the ozone layer was more than just from that one volcanic eruption. Was more than all the damage that all mankind had done throughout the history of mankind to the ozone layer.
There's also, I was listening yesterday on the radio again, they had three guests on Stuart White's program where there was one lady who had written a book about the paganization of the ecology movement. And they had a couple of people on, but one of the things that was brought up has never, ever been discussed in my mind, particularly about the idea of ozone destruction, ozone depletion, is that there is a volcano somewhere in the South Seas, I don't remember the name of it, I've heard it a couple of times, that every day erupts and emits something like 50 times the amount of man's total... mankind's total contribution to the destruction. So 50 times more than that every day of what man can produce in 1 year. And I've heard the same thing about Pinatubo, something like 300 times that of what man produces in 1 year.
And there's, I wouldn't doubt that at all. Now, the other side of the coin is, though, we don't want to be fanatics. At the same time, we do want to be faithful. God gave man dominion over the earth. And so I can go to McDonald's and enjoy a good cheeseburger. At the same time, I don't think that we should kill animals needlessly or just for fun and that type of thing. We ought to be faithful stewards of what God has given us dominion over, and we ought to treat it as good as possible. I believe that our government needs to make certain restrictions so that big businessmen and their attempt to make millions, that they don't pollute us to death. At the same time, they should not make so many restrictions that it makes American businesses hard to compete with Mexican businesses and or Japanese businesses or whatever. So
Or you shouldn't cover up the rainforest just to make real estate, right?
Yeah. I'll be the first guy to defend the spotted owl if somebody could give me one good reason why we need that thing to keep on existing. I've yet to hear one good, you know, if somebody says, oh, it's a vital part of the food chain. If this doesn't happen, then this will happen. You know, I've heard good. I kill spiders on a regular basis, but I'm glad that nobody sets out to kill them all, because spiders kill a lot of bugs.
Yeah.
And spiders serve a pretty good role. And granted, I don't like to see 300 of them in my house at the same time. It's nice to know there's a couple around my house. But a spotted owl, like I said, I've yet to hear one good article or argument of one thing
fossil.
That it does that really helps.
Species list?
What? Yeah, they're on an endangered species list. But
also,
like,
some of the fact that originally came up, you know, that they need 200 acres, that was falsified by some of the proactive spotted owl people.
There is an agenda that goes beyond the spotted owl. Is one of the things that lies behind the wacko ecology movement is worldwide communism. So there's a big attack on business and industry. And so you'll find some ludicrous arguments that don't make a lot of sense. For instance, in California, when the fires were going all over the place, they found some endangered bird that was living in that area. So fire department was going to start a fire, a man-made fire, which would not be, and a man-made controlled fire wouldn't be as bad as the regular natural fire that was going to be going through, burn everything down in this area so that when the fire comes up to that area, that would already be burned. It would just die out, and it wouldn't go on into a residential area.
That can be a standard practice.
Well, what happened was the New Agers were arguing that you can't do that because of the endangered species that are there. Yet, the facts remain, the endangered species would have like something like 1,000 times the chance of surviving if the man-made fire is set there. They'd have much more chance of surviving than if you allow the natural fire, which is much more hotter and totally uncontrolled, if that goes through. And says, but these people were saying these little birds were more important than the human beings on the other side, but to just get that message out to the public, little birds are more important than humans, than the houses of humans. Like up here, spotted owls are more important than thousands and thousands of jobs for humans, which feeds their families.
Life is still important, no matter if it's a bird or a man.
But at the same time, not on the same level. And the thing is, too, is do animals have rights?
No.
Yep, the answer is they do not have rights. Rights demand responsibility. And I do not devour. You need moral values, the ability to make moral decisions. I do not devour if I devour my neighbor, go next door and just tear him to shreds, I'm going to lose my rights. They're going to either put me in an electric chair or lock me up for good. But animals do that to each other every day. They're tearing each other to shreds left and right. No rights, no responsibility. My dog go outside and go to bathroom on a totally naked. Go to bathroom on a front lawn in front of everybody and their mother's brother. You could be looking at my dog. No shame whatsoever. He'll sit down, just squat down and start going to bathroom right in front of me. There's no responsibility, moral responsibility. There's no intelligence. There's no rights there. Now, the reason why it's wrong for us to kill animals randomly, you know, just for fun or whatever, it's not because of their rights, it's because God has given them to us as a gift, and we should not abuse the gifts that God has given us.
Now, a lot of the ecologists also, they believe in keeping everything natural and letting things run its natural course. I guess you could say the survival is the fittest theory. But aren't they going against that by saying, well, you can't cut down these trees because of the owl? I mean, the owl will fly away away and make a new home.
Most of the survival of the fittest thing has been watered down, and most evolutionists don't hold it. I think they would be more consistent if they did hold it. If they held to it, if we're the dominant species and we're trampling everything else down, you know, I believe that creation by God implies human equality. All men are created equal. Our founding fathers agree. But I believe evolution implies survival of the fittest. And there have been some evolutionists who say that if evolution is true, and they believe that it was, then nature is red in tooth and claw. In other words, devouring your neighbor is just part of life. And
it's required.
Yeah. So it's, you know, yeah, it's
well,
required to advance and stuff.
It's a moral imperative.
But now a lot of them are getting a lot of evolutionists are getting away from that. But I think it's more than results of their experiments. I think it's more of
personal.
Well, yeah, it's just we live in a, you know, back then. Let's face it, when Darwin was writing, slavery was still legal. So if it was legal for one man to suppress and whip the back of another man and force him to do work for them totally against the guy's will, then survival of the fittest doesn't sound like such a bad thing. But then when you come into a modern America where everybody's got rights and all, and human beings rightfully so, all of a sudden survival of the fittest doesn't sound so good anymore.
How would they argue against that, then, this idea of the survival of the fittest? I don't understand exactly how they could, and yet,
there's some that will still use the phrase survival of the fittest, but it doesn't mean the strongest shall survive like it used to. They would just say it's the most adaptable to your environment. For instance, a single-celled animal might be more fit than a dinosaur, because he was able to adapt to changing climate, whereas the dinosaur, maybe the ice age came along or something, you know, something that removed the vegetation he needed, he wasn't able to. So number one, the survival of the fittest has left only the strong shall survive. It's left the realm of being strong, and those who still hold it, it would be the ones that can adapt better. But there's multiples of different views as to what species are going to survive and continue on. And I don't know what the prevalent theory is right now, but there's just, you know, different kinds. I think most of them just focus on the mutations, helpful mutations that would help you better survive. So a little bit of the survival of the fittest would still come out, but
with like dinosaurs and evolution, I mean, like, how do you feel like about the meteor strike theory, that some meteor, you know, caused a big dust cloud to hit Earth, caused a dust cloud and caused this ice age that, you know, dinosaurs could not adapt to?
If you had a worldwide flood,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't need to invent meteors coming out of the heavens, because a worldwide flood, the very next thing to follow would be an almost complete global ice age. So yeah, that just plain
water cooled it down.
You know, no creationist or evolutionist would disagree with that, but they want the global ice age. They just don't want the flood. So you don't have to, you know. And then the other thing is, the worldwide flood would explain why there's been so much fossilization over the entire globe, whereas evolution can't even explain it with millions and millions of years. Even the present rate.
Mm-hmm.
You go back that same rate throughout all time, and you're not going to.
With the meteor strike, where did the excess moisture come from to create these giant glaciers that covered most of the Earth?
I don't know if they say that this giant meteor hit it and knocked the Earth off its axis a little, and did something in its relation to the sun, and maybe that caused it, I don't know exactly how they would work it out, but I do know most of their explanations. The thing is, too, is what would that also defeat, that giant meteor? It would also defeat uniformitarianism. Because if it was big enough to cause a global ice age, it was big enough to break, to change the processes to such a degree that you'd have a global ice age. So, you know, what they're robbing from Peter to give to Paul. You know, they're destroying one part of their model to help another part. And but usually what they do, because they don't want these worldwide catastrophes, they usually invent little minor catastrophes. For instance, we have in the fossil record, in different layers that were supposed to take millions of years to fall, we have whales standing straight up. How does a whale not rot over millions of years? So they invent some kind of little local earthquake or something that keeps the layers intact, but somehow pops that whale in there. You got the same with trees, polystrate trees going through different strata. You've also got, and of course a tree can't be millions of years old. You've also got skeletons of whales on the tops of mountains in Canada and California. Now, their theories are tidal waves. Just a tidal wave just toss a whale on the top of a mile-high mountain. You know,
you even got some. That's a flood.
Well, I would say two things. I would say two things. If it happened on a local scale, you can have local floods, but you just can't have a universal flood. If it happened on a local scale, it's unbelievable to me. Mm-hmm. If it happened on a universal scale, then it's believable, especially if it was a worldwide flood and the whale just ended up on the top of a mountain because the mountain was under the ocean. And then when everything settled,
stuck in a ridge.
Yeah, and so that's believable to me. But then it throws away uniformitarianism, and you're right back in Genesis 6-9. So,
what was I going to say? When you're talking about fossilization records and all that, they get into, well, you know, the dinosaurs were buried really quickly. You know, we find these fossils because of volcanic eruptions. You know, and they got buried under molten lava and stuff. I mean, that's a good explanation, too, other than those molten lava.
Carbon-based.
There's different...
Destroy the bones.
You can explain the order, the supposed order that's given for the fossil record. The flood would tend to bury the fossils in the same order. You'd have deep ocean creatures buried first, then the creatures in shallower water. Then on top of them would be amphibians and land-bordering creatures. And on top of them would be swamp, marsh, and low river flat creatures, especially reptiles. The higher mammals who retreated to higher ground attempting to escape the flood would be on the next level. And then last, humans would be overtaken. So that could be explained just as easily by creation as by evolution. But the problem for evolution is that order is not there.